This week on Preacher Handshake, we talk with James Williams, the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Philadelphia, PA. That church has been serving the city of brotherly love for more than 325 years. And prior to accepting his call at that church, James attended Palmer Theological Seminary, where he earned his MDiv, and he's passionate about his work with marginalized groups within society, particularly in Philadelphia and their unhoused population and the LGBT plus community. He's currently pursuing a PhD in theology and homiletics at Eastern University. And in his personal life, James loves reading and drumming and spending time with his family, including his wife, Michelle, his dog, Eleanor Rigby, and many, many cats. We talked to James about preaching in his context of place and people and time. And we specifically looked at a sermon he delivered at FBC Philly on January 26th, 2025. This sermon is based on Luke 4, 14 through 21. And you can watch the whole thing at the link in our show notes.
Yeah, I really enjoyed getting to know James. He just has a fantastic personality and was really engaging to listen to in preaching. One of the things that really caught my attention about him is the language that he uses. He's very poetic and it draws you in a way that I think is sometimes hard and difficult for a lot of preachers, but he just did it so effortlessly. And it was really cool to talk to him about how he got to that preaching process. And then I loved the way that he talked so much about his congregation. You can tell that he is deeply invested in his community, that he knows his people. And that is, I think, reflected so much in his preaching and in his preaching philosophy.
Yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to talk with James is because, you know, they talk about you'll know them by their fruit. And when I've observed James, not even just as a preacher, but as a pastor, I'm just kind of mesmerized with the way that he cares and pastors so well, the way he loves people and people that other people might not notice. I've noticed James paying special attention to people. And he's the kind of person that just exudes joy. And in days when joy can be difficult, I wanted to hear how James was navigating that with his congregation and in a congregation that's incredibly diverse. So I hope you enjoy our conversation with James Williams. James Williams, thank you for being with us, for sharing with us today, pastor of the First Baptist Church of Philadelphia. And a good friend and a great preacher. And we're just so honored to have you today and to be able to talk about your message, a message that is linked in the show notes. And we encourage our listeners to check that out in full. But we'll be talking about it and hearing from it throughout our conversation.
We're so excited to have you on. So kind of one of the things we want to get to know about you is, what is your relationship to preaching?
Yeah, I gave my first sermon when I was 18, and I felt connected to preaching even then. I think I've always had a connection to communication, and this is like a secular calling to communication. I like people. I love people, and I love communicating, and I think I've always had a talent for it. But it wasn't until I went to seminary that I discovered, preaching might just be something that I'm really called to do. Like, I'm not just effective at it. I love this. I went to seminary with the idea that I was going to be an academician. I just wanted to learn more about the Bible that I loved and religion. And I did not have a particular pastoral call. I don't know that I saw myself as a senior pastor. I saw myself in academic institutions. But right when seminary started, you know, you get paired with theological field education and things like this. And I started interacting more with congregations on a professional level. And I found that the pastoral ministry is indeed, like, dare I say, what I'm made for. It's like, and I should say, I didn't think much of this, but I'm a fifth generation pastor. So maybe there's something in the DNA or something that just, like, you know, there's something very special about the pastoral calling. And the more I've leaned into it, the more I've been blessed. So I've moved away from an academic lean. I am a professor, an adjunct professor. I teach Bible, but that is not my passion. My passion has become preaching. And I would say, I mean, it takes up a good chunk, probably 20 to 30 hours a week of my time. And I absolutely love it, truly. And I think it's one of my stronger giftings in the ministry, too.
I did not know you were a fifth generation pastor. I'm like doing the math in my head. That's amazing.
It's funny how it works out that way.
And when I went to seminary, I also was hoping to be an academic. And the same thing, just fell in love with pastoral work and preaching. And yeah, it's just the same thing. Feel like that's what I was made to do. So now you're serving at the First Baptist Church in Philadelphia. Tell us a little bit about your congregation. Who are they? What are they like?
Yeah, they're very special. So I've been here for a little bit over 5 years now, but the congregation is in their 326th year of ministry. They've been in Philadelphia since 1698. Historically diverse. However, we are a multicultural church. That's how it was billed to me when I came to the congregation, and I see that played out in our demographics. It's pretty unique. So we're 52% African American, 39% Caucasian, and then the rest is a smattering of diversity. And I love that about it. And we're in Center City, Philadelphia, and we are economically diverse as well. On a Sunday, our Sunday average, when I came, it was 17. Our Sunday average is 43 now. So that 102% increase we're thrilled about, but if you come on a Sunday, you'd see maybe 6 to 10 members of the homeless community, and then you'd also be sitting next to 1 to 2 millionaires, like that kind of thing. It's very diverse. It's a very special community where we are very intentional about being incarnational, if you guys are familiar with this idea. So I live in the community. We immerse ourselves in the community. And for us, that means a lot of service to both the people who live here, which is 78% young urban professionals. They tend to be male, making over $80,000 a year. But then the homeless community is our immediate need. So we're pretty adamant about feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, visiting the imprisoned, that kind of thing. And I think we actually get into that in the sermon I gave too. So it's a very special community, and I'm glad to be here.
I was just admiring how, sometimes I think churches like to sell us on, like, we're diverse, we promise. But it sounds like your church is really like trying to embody that. And that's really encouraging to hear.
Yes, and I was grateful. I came to the church partially because I sensed that intentionality. They were keen on being direct about this in the calling process. And indeed, a concern too was that I am very Caucasian, and there was concern that that would limit the diversity, and that was a concern for me too. We've been blessed to not see a homogenizing of our congregation, but actually the diversity continues to increase. But part of that is through, the intentionality of the congregation. We now have a minister of international ministries, started as international or minister of Asian ministries, and these are through efforts through the American Baptist Churches. They helped us with some grant funding to make this possible. So I think the key there is just being really intentional about this. And it is, we don't all, most of us probably live in more homogenous communities, but Center City, Philadelphia is more diverse. So we try to match the community that surrounds us, although we don't match our immediate zip code for sure.
So you mentioned that you spend, 20, 30 hours a week maybe working on a sermon. So walk us through what does a typical week look like for sermon prep? What are resources maybe, that you're running to often? What does that look like for you to prepare?
Yeah, so the process for me usually starts on a Monday. Sometimes it starts on a Sunday. But essentially, what I'm doing is I use a lectionary. I started using one in 2020 and have really enjoyed it. And I was hesitant about jumping to a lectionary. The congregation here at First Baptist has never employed one. And so we were hesitant too. It was a practical thing during COVID when I was recording from my home, and I like the idea of. I like the ironic nature of praying with other churches and not picking my scriptures, but it's actually been stunningly beautiful. So I have all the lectionary scriptures laid out, and we keep a worship spreadsheet. And so actually, our whole year is done right now with the scriptures. So those who make the bulletins, they can get going. But what I do is I pick out for my sermons where the focus is going to be, and then I wrestle with those scriptures and figure out. or try and discern where the spirit is moving me to focus. I see my task, and this is just like my little like mantra. I'm bringing the word of God for the people for that day. And that can be daunting. It is a spirit-filled task. So I have had to learn and continue to learn to lean into the movement of the spirit. And I say that, you know, this is an ambiguous experience, one that involves, you know, a lot of deliberation and such. And so I'll start usually by outlining. And since 2021, I was impacted by my mentor, Tony Campolo. We were talking about sermons and all this, and he told me something that we were talking about his own homiletical model. And he told me something that an Alfred Williams at Mount Carmel Baptist, where he had attended for some years, had told him. And he says, if you don't know what to say, you're going to do 3 points. 3 points in an illustration. And we know that, you know, that's like pretty typical in the homiletical world, the 3 points in the illustration. But here was the key. If you don't know what your 3 points are, here's what they are. Point one, there is good news. Illustration. Point two, this news is tremendously paradigm shifting, world changingly good news. Illustration. Third point, now that you know this good news, what are you going to do about it? Illustration. I usually close with like an action, which was a Tony thing too. So it sounds simple, but when I started this model, I was scared, I think. It wasn't my typical preaching model. I tended to be really heady and academic, and the storytelling was not part of my tradition. Maybe a story, you know? This was a lot of story. Well, I'll tell you, it has been like, I want to choose my language carefully because all glory be to God, but it has just been life-changing in the homiletical delivery. And so now I consider myself a storyteller too. So I'm always looking for stories. And I guess I'll share with you some of the resources I go to for stories as well, outside of my own life too. But I spend a great deal of time outlining, you know, and just little notes. Here's the story I want to tell here. Here's the point I want to tell here. And then usually by Thursday is when I'll start to put this down into words. And I don't do it all in one shot. I take it's like a percolation or a rumination. Thursday and Friday, I'm kind of just at my computer, stepping away, coming back, at my computer, stepping away, coming back. And then usually by Saturday, I have something done. I remember in seminary, I had a homiletics professor, Dr. Farmer, who said that typically the rule of thumb is for every minute you preach, you'll do an hour of prep. And I found that to be largely true. And so for me, my aim is to do 19 minutes. My sermons are 23 to 24 minutes. So that's why I keep that 19-minute aim. And I have to say, I like where my length is at and all that. I can get accomplished, I think, this task of creating movement and action in people. But I don't know that I can hold them in our context much longer than that. I mean, I'm pulling out all the stops and the stories and all that by 19 minutes. I'm really trying to hang on to them, you know? And I find that putting in the work is worth the effort as well. And I find that the spirit of God has in the whole process, or else I'll feel like I'm giving a lecture and not interacting with people where they are on that day in that week, to hear what God has to say for their life.
What a great mentor to have. And I'm just thinking about the different models I've used and thought through and have not used one quite like that, but beautiful. So we want to shift and talk about a particular sermon with you today. And this one is from January 26th of 2025. And so we're going to dive into it, but want to orient ourselves a little bit in the moment of time that we're in on January 26th, right? So we're coming right out of the inauguration. Like, before I ask specific questions about this message, kind of how are you feeling entering into the preaching event, trying to tell this good news, life-changing good news in the midst of all the things that you're feeling, but also that your community is engaging with and feeling?
Part of that is the context I'm in, and we're all preaching in different contexts. And so In Center City, Philadelphia, politics are largely homogenous compared to what you'd find in the suburbs. They're not homogenous, but they're largely homogenous. And I'm speaking to particular demographics and things like that. And all that to say, a lot of us share similar sentiments about the inauguration and new administrations and things that are going on. But what I find is that if I'm honest and I frame things with a sense of humility, like, so you'll encounter, I'll say things like, I talk about free will. I'll say, like, I believe in free will. I'm not saying that free will is a necessity, just that I believe it. It's a way, I think, of inviting people to join me in my story. And then maybe I can invite them, I can invite myself to join in their story. And maybe we'll find middle ground in the midst of this. But yes, so this sermon was given right after the inauguration. And I mentioned I use a lectionary. I did not choose these texts. But what I found was that this was essentially so this is from Luke 4 is one of the main texts, and it's considered an inaugural address, at least in Luke's gospel, for Jesus. And you know, he gets up and he quotes from Isaiah, and then he puts the scroll down and he says, this is fulfilled in your hearing. And then he would begin to preach, which isn't in Luke. So we actually don't know what he preached, by the way, which is interesting. We just know the scripture that he was using that day. And then he sat down. And then when you sit down is when you give a sermon. But anyway, that was a beautiful moving of the spirit, because I did not pick the scriptures, and yet the inaugural address still shows up in it. And actually, I didn't make that connection, the inaugural address connection, until like 48 hours before Sunday. Like, I was reviewing the sermon, putting the things, and I'm like, oh wait, this is Jesus's inaugural address, and this is the week of the inaugural address, and we have different thoughts about it. So let's hone in on what Jesus says in Jesus's inaugural address. And so that was, you know, one of those beautiful spirit-filled experiences. And friends, I have to say, they happen all the time. God is good. God works in the homiletic process. And you know, I haven't been doing this for too long. I'm in my 5th year now, and the more I lean into the Spirit of God working through the development of our sermons, the more rewarded I am. The Spirit moves, and it's beautiful. And the Spirit will move through our sermons. We just have to listen and attune ourselves to the experience, I think.
I preached different lectionary that week too, and was really grateful for that text. Same thing, just powerful stuff. We're gonna dive into the sermon. You start with the poem based on Galatians, and it's this powerful and poetic way to begin. So we're gonna look at that.
The book of Galatians says, "It is for freedom that Christ has set us free." That's an important verse to me. I am free to be free. That's what the gospel says to me. Chains are broken. I can see grace has set my spirit free. No more guilt, no more shame. Jesus called me by my name. In God's love, I will remain through all life's joy and through life's pain. I'm here to tell you today that Jesus does set you free. You've heard a lot this week about the inaugural address. I'm sure you're tired of hearing about it. Me too. But let me tell you something this morning about another inaugural address. By the way, we use a lectionary. I don't pick these scriptures. These are the scriptures that the Spirit had picked for us. I'm going to tell you about Jesus's inaugural address.
What a way to begin, man. I really love poetry. I love like crafting these really beautiful, lengthy sentences. And you do this so well, not just here, but throughout, where it seems like you use alliteration and you use lots of rhyming and things like that. In preaching class, you know, we'd call your intro like your hook. You've got to like, what is the thing that draws them in? And I heard this and I was like, okay, I'm in. Like, I'm ready. This is what I came here for. So I'm curious, you know, do you normally begin your sermons in this way? And is that kind of like typical for your preaching?
So the first few sentences of my sermon are the hardest for me. So just introducing them, getting them in, is very hard for me. As I'm hearing this, I think what I'm reflecting on is an intro to a very famous sermon or set of sermons by Tony Campolo. I think he started off his Friday but su Sunday's coming often with this line. He'd say, he's quoting Romans, he'd say, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. That's an important verse to me. I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ because the gospel of Christ meets every need of every human being on this planet. And then he would go into his thing. And so I think that's what I'm taking here. I have recently, maybe in the past 8 months, started incorporating poetry and alliteration. I kind of stumbled upon it. I'm impacted particularly by my African American preachers in Philadelphia, and alliteration is a powerful tool and one that I have been drawn to. And so I've been slowly putting it in, and I have found that people really respond to it. People will write me and say, "Oh, can you send me, this poem or this poetry?" Or like, I think it was last week, I did a whole poem naming each member and a gift that they've done. And people really like that stuff. It's worth the effort for me, I guess, is what I'm saying. It pulls you in and that kind of thing. Yeah, so this would be my hook. Jesus sets you free. And that's actually my first point. So amidst all the talking, I don't know if it's clear in this sermon what my points are, and I don't know if that's a weakness or a strength. But the very first point I'm trying to make is Jesus sets you free. And then the second point I'll make is Jesus sets you free wherever you may be. Wherever you are, Jesus can do it. And then the third point is usually for me more of an action. And so the action here is choose God or choose Jesus. Yeah, so that is my intro. That's how I'm trying to get them hooked. And then I'll use stories. Here I use I paraphrase and quote in combination this thing from Luke 4. And then the rest of the sermon, I'm using a lot of extra biblical stories, so stories that are not in the Bible to illustrate this biblical truth.
I love that you brought up your colleagues in Philadelphia, because as I was listening for the first time, and I wasn't making Tony connections, but this works too with Tony, but I was just hearing from cadence and style so many influences from African American preaching. And the African American preaching movement and a movement to Calvary and influences deeply influenced me and my preaching as well. Can you tell us a little bit about, beyond Tony, some of the other influences you've had, how that's been formed, and how you've brought that into the pulpit, which in a context like yours that's so diverse, I mean, what a wonderful way to be able to use those gifts and pull on these different influences. But I'd love to hear about those influences that you have.
Yeah, and it's been shifting. You have a good ear, a keenness. Yeah, I don't know how intentional it is, but I'm very impacted by African American preachers, particularly in my region, because so I should explain, I'm an American Baptist, and I'm part of the First Baptist is part of the Philadelphia Baptist Association, which is I think the oldest such association of its sort, for Baptists, at least in North America. And we, not historically, but in the past few decades, we have become predominantly African American, to a very large degree. There really was, I mean, it's controversial, but essentially a lot of the white and suburban church left the PBA to join an alternative region, and those that stayed within the Philadelphia Baptist Association tend to be African American, with a few exceptions. I can't say that First Baptist is the exception because we're not Caucasian dominant, but we are heavily Caucasian, and I am Caucasian. But so when we go to these gatherings, or I'm invited to prayer services, I mean, the Baptist, what I'm saying is the Baptists in Philadelphia tend to be black, and they tend to be my colleagues, and I'm very impacted by what they have to say. And then my favorite preachers to listen to are like Howard John Wesley at Alfred Street Baptist. He was Barack Obama's pastor when he was in D.C., and he is a gifted preacher. I like Otis Moths III, Marvin McMickle. Who's, I guess, technically more of an academic than a homiletician. He's been impactful for me as well, though. But locally, like these are names that are familiar to those in Philadelphia, but probably not so far outside of it. Gus Roman, Wendell Mapson, Eric Good, Alan Waller, Sean James, Danielle Brown. She's not in Philadelphia, she's in Delaware. Quentin Robertson. These are people that have impacted me. And then as I get invited to these events, I guess I notice just my own style, trying to match that of the other speakers. And this is what it's turned into. You can see the impact, though, also of African American preaching styles, even in how I dress. So when I first came to the church, I didn't robe or anything like that. Someone made comment. They said, in our churches, we like our pastors robed. And I said, okay, we'll try it for the first Sunday of the month. It's been very meaningful, particularly to the African American members of the First Baptist community, that I robe. And so I've continued to do that because I can see how it impacts their worship. For them, it's a bringing back to the church of their youth, a certain high church with kind of low homiletics, if I can say that. I don't know. The homiletics are supposed to be, for me, really accessible because, again, it's a very diverse congregation. But there's something about our context, 326 years, the diversity within it, that lends itself to the robing. But the African American tradition, I'm glad to see you can see some elements of it in my speaking. There's part of that is the language I'm familiar with. I don't know if it's true, is called hooping, which is kind of these ramp ups. They're coming under criticism in the younger generations in Philadelphia, and we can see that in churches like for us locally, Dare to Imagine, and these churches that are predominantly African American, but the young generations don't seem to respect the hooping. This is something that they vocalize, but rather they want to enter into a conversation. And so I'm trying to be intentional about this. I still find value in the hooping, the spirit cathartic filled moment, but that can't be all of what our sermon is. There has to be, I'm finding at least, there has to be some meat in there for people to chew on, and particularly the younger folk in my context. We're diverse in age, so when I first came, we were all very old, and we are now bringing in people from our immediate community, and they tend to be in their late teens, early 20s, first career. And so that's very different. And indeed, they are a different bunch as well. So I think we're trying to find a middle ground between this old and new style, but both informed by the African American traditions.
I'll just commend you on your understanding and ability and sensitivity to kind of embody your community. And you mentioned being incarnational before, but this idea of who is our community, what do they need, how can I serve them best and serve the people that we're reaching, and that requires adjustment on you and your style and all of your preparation. And oftentimes I think we want to make everybody else adjust to us, which doesn't work and is not sensitive and realistic. And I think being part of a historic church too, you're standing in this long river of history, and it kind of takes some of that ego away, where we're submitting to serving these people in their midst. And I just would applaud you for that. It's really beautiful to see, and it's really reflected in this sermon.
When I first came to First Baptist, I was very intimidated. I had there were other calls, and I'm trying to discern where God is leading me to. And First Baptist was unique. It was the only one. It wasn't the only urban context, but it was the only one in a center city context with this historical thing, and the only one that wasn't predominantly white. And I took the call at First Baptist through movings to the Spirit. And I remember coming. That's my way of saying it's a long story, but I remember coming down to the city a week before I started, and out in front of what is now a Starbucks on Chestnut Street, a block away. And I remember looking at all the people walk by, and I didn't grow up in the city. I grew up in the suburbs. Upper Darby is where I'm from, a small or a large suburb outside of Philadelphia. But I did not grow up in the city proper, and all these people are walking by, and I was so intimidated. I've never seen all these people, or never taken it all in. And I remember praying, God, how am I going to do this? Like, how am I going to do this? And I felt very strongly in my heart, a saying, well, James, you're not going to do it. I'm going to do it. And you just need to be here, be obedient. And so I have. And it's been hard at times, but tremendously rewarding. And so I love to talk about First Baptist. And you all are being very nice and making me feel good about my ministry. But honestly, it's just been a partnering with the spirits, and I think God brought me here, and has been very patient with me in allowing me to interact with this very new community. And it's been tremendously rewarding. I really like the context. I like urban ministry. When I was in suburban ministry, it's just a little different. Like you have to be more intentional about hearing the needs. But here they knock on the door. Like, if you could hear it, probably my doorbell's rung like six times. So it's an entirely different thing. And it's frustrating because we want to help so much and we have limited capacity. And so how do we balance that as well? But these are all things that we get to hash out in a sermon. And I think it's a beautiful intersection of us meeting our congregants where they are in the moment.
I love how in tune you are with your community and the needs of the people around you. And also, you seem very aware of, the power and the privilege it comes with being in a place where we stand up and we preach to people who have real lives and experiences and in some ways are hurting or vulnerable and things like that. And kind of this dichotomy too of like the Christian life, right? And you actually, it leads really well into something that you preached in the middle of your sermon. One of the concepts that you really focused on was this idea of like jubilee, this idea of, things being made right and debts being repaid, and this like glorious vision that I think on our best moments and on our best days, Christians are like, yes, this is what we want. But then you kind of did something that I thought was really interesting, which was bringing in kind of like your own discouragement, critique, maybe, of this experience, which I think is really indicative of your evaluation of the way that people process hope and life and what it really means to live, like this. So let's listen to it.
I had lunch with one of you on Tuesday, and I said, you've caught me in a unique position because today is the first day in my life where I've woken up and thought seriously, I want to live somewhere else. I'm glad some can relate. And if you don't, that's okay too. I don't feel like a jubilee is anywhere in the horizon. Not for me, not for us. I don't anticipate an evening of the playing fields, a resetting of the table, or a reshuffling of the decks. Not in my reality, my temporal reality. I don't feel these things. But the good news of the gospel is this. This good news of the gospel is that Jesus sets me free wherever I may be. You say, James, you're being naive. James, you're crazy. James, you're impractical. It's like Nietzsche says, Christianity is for the weak, the uncourageous, the uninspired, the complacent. God is dead. I disagree.
Did you have any hesitation with sharing kind of your own vulnerability, your own frustrations on one hand, and then also to share something so academic? Like Nietzsche. I mean, both of those things I think were maybe could be categorized as risks. Did you have any hesitation to taking those on?
Not in my context, I don't, because I know my congregation. We've grown together for 5 years. And that's not to say that everyone agrees with me. Certainly not everyone in my congregation agrees with me. We're diverse in that way as well. We vote differently and things like that. But again, I want to say too that I have more license to do these kind of things because I am more in line with the majority of the political leanings of my congregation in Center City, urban Philadelphia, than someone like you, Evan, in a more diverse Baptist Church of Westchester, Yeah, I can do these things. And part of it is the rapport I think I have with the congregation as well. And I think there's something about the honesty that's appreciated as long as I approach it with humility. So, like, I don't go in and say, I try not to at least lay down absolutes because that seems dangerous for a variety of ways. But what I do say is, I believe, I think. This is where I'm at, that kind of thing. And this is true. This is where I'm at. And the reason I shared it is because the the pulse of my congregation that I'm feeling is that they are feeling a similar thing. So that's my way of saying it's okay to feel this way. It's okay to feel this way. And there's good news in the midst of that. And so you mentioned mentioning Nietzsche. One of my early struggles is, and I've been accused of this. Sometimes I speak more academic than I should. And I think part of it is just, we immerse ourselves in the schoolwork. And I'm still coming out of seminary, and now I'm in a PhD with Evan, and the language kind of sticks around, I read, though, in Dr. King's autobiography, maybe it was a biography, I don't remember. I read of Dr. King, though, that people questioned why he was so academic in his preaching. And there was a whole cultural answer that he gave, like, in the African American situation, we need to show that we're educated. And, when the whole world is saying that we're dumb and can't, we need to show them that we walk with the best of them. And Dr. King was quite an academic. He was in the liberal school of theology at the time, which is an uncomfortable place for evangelicals of 2025, probably not known so well, but like he wasn't, my understanding is like the historicity of the Bible was not a concern for Dr. King, as is the geist of the academic, particularly academically liberal of the day. But anyway, he makes mention that he doesn't have an inclination to dumb down his words. Rather, he expects that the congregation is smarter than he gives them credit for. And so I've leaned into that a little bit. Like that has given me a little license, to say, you know what, I'm just going to say what I say. But part of my context too is people are really smart. I don't know that we always give them credit for it. I heard there's a priest, John Dominic Kasson. He's at DePaul University in Chicago, but he's from Ireland, and he's a great scholar. He talks about how, he grew up in Ireland where people were illiterate in two languages, but it would be a mistake to think that they are dumb because they're illiterate in two languages. They're quite smart. And I find that the people in the pews are smarter than we give them credit for. They can take context clues. They're interested in this. And then another part of it is, because of the diversity of our audience, this stuff really clicks with the academics in our congregation. And we do have quite a bit of academics. That seems to be a particular, not our sole magnet, but we are magnetic towards the local Ivy League students. We have Penn right around the corner, and so we get a lot of Penn students. For whatever reason, I don't know why, we have so many Harvard grads here, which is very intimidating, by the way. And they seem to like it. Most of them have stuck around for 4 or 5 years. So I feel like I can do this. I feel like I can invite people in. I think they appreciate it. I think they're like, I'm learning something, so that even if I'm not a Christian listening, I just learned something about Nietzsche's arguments against Christianity. And by the way, I think I'm borrowing actually from Dr. King and his own reflections on Nietzsche. And notice this was on January 24th. It's like a week after Martin Luther King Day here in the US. And so I'm sure that that was in my mind as well. So that's my way of saying this isn't all original. I'm pulling from moments that are around me.
Yeah, I love that you are able to say, like, let's give people a little bit more credit than that. I know that sometimes the temptation is to just dumb everything down, but there's really such richness that can be drawn from, and especially using sources that, are maybe not in the academic purview of a lot of people, and that's really interesting that you do that. One of the things, though, that I'm curious about is it seems like you also don't assume that people are unfamiliar with a lot of biblical text. And I'm saying that as someone who, like, I used to work a lot with young adults and college students. And I had, students who would come in who, truthfully, like, had not really had much of a background in church and didn't know a lot of biblical stories. And I remember our pastor used to say that at one point in one of the services, they just asked for a show of hands, like, who's heard of the story of David and Goliath, I think it was. There were so many people in the room who just didn't know it. And that has, I think, really shifted my preaching, the way that I think about, especially as you're saying, you have younger people who maybe aren't as biblically literate as could have been assumed. But you seem to assume that people are aware of things. This one section in your sermon in particular, you talk a lot about biblical stories. So I wanna look at that and then ask a follow-up question about it.
Jesus frees us in our lives. Jesus frees us in our careers. Jesus frees us in our relationships. Jesus frees us in the concentration camps and the pandemics, in the politics. Jesus frees us in the midst of life's hardest trials. Peter was in a fishing boat when he was set free. The prodigal son was in a pig pen. Paul was on the road to Damascus persecuting Christians. One woman found freedom when caught in adultery. Another was drawing water from a well. One thief found freedom while hanging on a cross. You have a savior. You have a Messiah, a liberator, a king who sets you free wherever you may be. He's here to proclaim the year of Jubilee. Jesus sets you free wherever you may be.
Yeah, I really love that you kind of just weave this idea of Jubilee and you connect it through all these different points of scripture. It was really powerful and really moving. And also, I can imagine if you have people there who are maybe not as familiar, what is that relationship like for them? So I'm curious, as somebody who you seem to know a lot about your congregation, that obviously you felt like this was appropriate for them. So how do you gauge, not just whether they can handle Nietzsche, but whether they can handle some of these other biblical stories without going in depth, and having to take the time to unpack every single thing you do?
And that's a really good observation, Hannah, because what I'm finding and have continued to find, and particularly now teaching at undergrads, is people in general are not familiar with their Bible the way that we pastors are. I discovered that in seminary. I went to seminary and I knew I was going to seminary. A few months before I went to seminary, and so I was like, you know what, I got to read this Bible. Like, I've read parts of it, big parts of it, but like, I got to read it straight through. And so I did one of those Bible 90-day plans and, tore it up and got to seminary and found that while people were familiar with the Bible, they weren't as familiar as I thought that they were going to be. And so that's been a continuing experience for me. Just most people have been to church their whole life. They're really still not familiar with the Bible stories, at least in the way that I anticipated them to be. Not everyone is us, is what I guess I'm getting at. And I find that to be particularly true in my congregation. There's different tensions. So some of the older members are probably familiar with these stories. These are a little bit more general too. But I wouldn't say that their Jubilee is probably something that's pretty new for them, or they've heard the word, but they don't remember coming across it, and a lot of the younger folks, which is the majority of our Sunday attenders, it's about half. I don't think that they're familiar with these stories. They might have a general understanding of like the prodigal son, but I don't even know that they make the connections that we do. Interesting, the people who know this tend to be the unhoused members of our worship. I mean, they really know it. Oh my goodness. On what we hold Bible studies here on Wednesday, and we do it Zoom and in person. And to be frank with you, we'll have a few people here in person. Most people come online, but those who come in person tend to be in the unhoused community, and they know their Bibles very well. They have a different lens in which they approach the Bible than I. And so we get to these really great conversations. But yeah, they know their stories really well. I mentioned these stories, and I do a lot of, and I don't know how healthy it is, but I do a lot of single verses throughout, and I kind of pick that up, I think, from like William Willimon, who was at Duke. He used to do a similar kind of thing. He'd finish a story and he'd say, "I think this is what Paul means when he says," and then insert, a fraction of a verse, that kind of thing. We do use a lectionary, and so there's this idea that after 3 years' time, they would be familiar with these stories, but I don't see that playing out so much. So I guess what I'm saying is, I use these stories. I hope that this is an invitation to discover more, but I don't expect that most people know what I'm talking about when I make big biblical references. If it's that important, then that becomes a point in my sermon and I explain it. So, for instance, the one I chose to unravel in this sermon was this Luke 4 thing with Jesus proclaiming this Isaiah year of the Jubilee thing. So that was their Bible lesson for the day. And then the rest of my sermons, recently at least, I use stories. And Jesus gives me license. He talks in parables, and parables are fictitious. And so it seems to be okay. And stories are a beautiful tool for navigating nuances and ambiguities and inviting people into experience. So, yeah, it's been beautiful.
That's just great insight. And I, in my own experience in the last few years here in Westchester, we have a significant unhoused population, and we have folks coming from a subsidized senior living community. And man, did they know, like, I've been in Bible studies where someone will be like, well, isn't that person's grandson so and so from like Second Kings? And I'm like, I don't know, but probably. And sure enough, right? It brings so much humility and also just appreciation to the breadth and the beauty and the depth of God's people. And it's so easy for us to look down on or think less of or underestimate all kinds of people, whoever they are in our context. And so I just love that.
Thank you.
I also in the sermon you bring up some big theological concepts, and one of them is free will. And you talk about free will and human choice, and you acknowledge that you believe in free will, but not everyone does. I think that was a beautiful way to bring up a theological concept. But I did want to ask about how you introduce the concepts, especially where there's a lot of diversity in both your congregation and just like the Christian history. I've often heard it said that we should preach from the center of our theology, right? Because maybe what's on the very edges of what I'm thinking is probably not ready to go out into a sermon. How do you determine when to bring along a theological insight or perspective or opinion, knowing that it's not potentially the majority or settled among your congregation?
Yeah, I think what's occurring there is when I think, and hopefully by I think, I mean, I hope that the Spirit is nudging me in some way in the preparation process to say, this might be valuable. This might be a gem for some people. And so I'll do that fairly often. I like to sneak in kind of these seminary theological concepts because they've been valuable to me. So like one I like to, make them say like prevenient grace and then be like, you guys are scholars now, and then they feel something of that. And then we talk about prevenient grace. Or so here we're talking about free will. I think I probably would have back in the day before I have this method, I would have talked about like Jacob Arminius or something and given a little history lesson, which just doesn't make great homiletics, And so I think how I do this is I think it's valuable for them. And so I'm honest. I say, I'm a big believer in free will. Not everyone is a big believer in free will. And that's the case, I think, in a lot of our theological pursuits is we can have leanings, but I really don't know the answer. I found valuable this idea that's articulated well in a book title of Dr. Pete Enns's, which is The Sin of Certainty. There is a certain idolization or putting of God in a box when we say, this is how God is. I think this is what Jesus is pushing against when he tells these parables. He's saying, well, maybe God is a little bit more than this. Well, God says to love my neighbor. And who is your neighbor? Well, let me tell you a story about this. And by the way, this is a good time for this. I think it's a if we get theological about it, the Catholics talk about what is it, the order of love or odor amoris or something like that. And that came up recently in some political discussions. Like first one of our politicians here, and I'll say I believe it was J.D. Vance, said, he thinks it's very Christian for us to first love our family and then our friends. And then our community, and then there's these concentric levels of love. that he was arguing for. But people rightly push back against that, and I think we see that in Jesus's stories. Jesus didn't go ahead and try to didactically explain the ordering of this love. Rather, he invites in the story, well, who is really loving their neighbor here? So I hope that that's what I'm doing when I make these big theological claims, is I'm inviting people into possibilities, not necessarily actualities, but something that I think could be a gem for them in this season of their life. And again, my hope is that this is all informed by a movement of the spirit that I have discerned in some way, which is just as murky or messy as it may even sound, frankly.
I really appreciate that, and I wanted to ask that question, and even as I ask it, I'm pushing back kind of in my own mind on some of that. Well, stay here. How do we create space for that question and mystery? And I think you do that so well with that, and I'm just really grateful. Your sermon takes a prophetic turn, I would say, as you talk more about Jubilee and what that means for us. And so I want to listen to that clip now.
Jesus has declared the year of the Lord's favor. Jesus has declared a jubilee, and this is good news for each of us. But here's the thing about the jubilee. Remember, we said this is a biblical mandate. There is no evidence, however, that the jubilee was ever practiced. The jubilee made its way into law, it's made its way into scripture, but it never made its way into society. And you and I both know why. Society is not great at freedom. We are not great at giving others freedom. We extort for gain. We limit societal safety nets. We price gouge the sick. We dismantle programs promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion. We make perpetual tenants of the poor freedom. In a world that rejects Jubilee, we need to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. We need to go to the world and declare that there is good news for the poor, release for the captives, sight for the blind. We go to the world and let them know that the oppressed shall be free. We go to the world and we share the news the world so desperately needs to hear. You know, I like to say that Jesus tells us that when we die, these will be the questions. I was naked. Did you clothe me? Hungry, did you feed me? Thirsty, did you give me drink? I was imprisoned, did you visit me? I was sick, did you care for me? I was a stranger and a foreigner, did you welcome me? But sadly, Jesus may say to some, I was hungry, and you formed a humanities club and discussed my hunger. I was imprisoned, and you crept off quietly to your chapel in the cellar to pray for my release. I was naked, and in your mind you debated the morality of my appearance and my smell. I was sick, and you knelt and thanked God for your own health. I was homeless, and you preached to me the spiritual shelter of God. I was lonely, and you left me alone to pray for me. I was a foreigner, and you locked me outside your gates. You threw me into internment camps. You seem so holy, Jesus might say, but I'm still so hungry, so lonely, so sick, so cold.
Wow, that was probably my favorite part of this whole thing. I love the way that you did that. It was funny when you that first kind of at the beginning of the clip when it first started, I got really excited because I'm hearing, you're saying we do have kind of this idea of going and proclaiming like, this is not the way that it should be, that there is freedom. And in my mind, I'm like, yes, this is great. And then I kind of have this voice going off where I'm like, wait, James, like, wait, what about like the action? What about that part that's missing there? Because, I think kind of the conviction sometimes is I think we're really guilty of preaching good news and not actually doing anything. And then you make this really beautiful turn where you're just like, here's actually what this looks like. Here's the questions that Jesus is going to ask us. Jubilee is not just this physical act, it's a spiritual one that we get to work. So I love that piece. Why did you think that that was an important message that your congregation needed to hear?
Well, I'll say that this has been one of those themes that has been on my heart, particularly for the last, I want to say 6 months, but I really don't know. But in particular, this section from Matthew 25, and part of it might be, I mean, this is a big emphasis for a pastor in my local area, Alan Waller at Enon Tabernacle. But Tony Campolo used to lean into this as well. And so I think I'm doing a similar thing there because it had a similar impact for me. Like this, so we're talking about the parable of the sheep and the goats, and the sheep and the goats will be separated, the sheep on the right and the goats on the left, and the goats are like, "What have we done?" And Jesus is like, "Well, whatever you did for the least of these, you did for me." I think I'm reacting a little to how I perceive shifts in the US and our concern for those that we in the Christian tradition have identified as the least of these. I've been consistent, I think, in at least while at First Baptist, in kind of an emphasis towards praxis, you know. But what and looking at these words of Jesus, you know, Jesus has a lot to say about like being rich, like don't be rich. You know, it's harder for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven than for a camel to go through an eye of the needle. And we don't turn to that medieval creation of like a gate on the side. You know, it seems like Jesus meant that literally. That's quite a challenge. But what I'm finding now is, which is new for me. I'm relatively young, 36, and you know, we're seeing shifts in social ethics, and we have been for some time. And these words, which did not seem so radical, now seem tremendously radical. And you know, a lot has changed in a year, and that's concerning. It's concerning because we are not a prosecuted people. I don't feel like, sorry, persecuted people in the US, not compared to first century Christians. That would be bogus, you know? I can say practically whatever I want without repercussion from the law in my church. However, I'm finding that now by quoting Jesus, people are starting to label me as a radical. One exercise I do with some students is I'll make them read just the red letters of Christ. Come to our conclusions, you know, so just the red letters. And they say these things like, they'll say things like, "Wow, Jesus was really radical. Jesus was really hardcore. Jesus was a kind of a communist, or Jesus was kind of a socialist." You know, they stick them into these categories that fit our 2025, you know, our system. But Jesus's words haven't changed. These translations haven't really changed, you know. It's just how we perceive them in light of our own context. And I think what I'm trying to say here is these words of Jesus did not seem too radical when I was beginning my Christian journey. They were like the standard. But right now, it's like an attack on social classes. When Jesus said these words, they were radical. There's a reason he tells parables, and probably not just because of ambiguities and nuance, but it allows those who wouldn't normally get to hear these kind of messages to hear them. And yet there are those who will not hear these messages. And there, you know, there is no persecution coming from Jesus immediately because of that. It's just kind of interesting, Hannah, that you mentioned that, because these things are not as radical, or they seem very radical, but they haven't changed. You know, these are the same words we've been preaching for 2,000 years.
Your insight is right on, and you know, something I'm feeling and we're seeing. And I think the temptation as a preacher, you know, and my context is not probably as politically homogenous as yours, but it still is, you know, because we're part of AWAB. And you know, when you make steps like that to be in the Association of Welcome and Affirming Baptists, people decide whether, you know, they want to be a part of your fellowship or not. And I think the temptation in this moment for people like us is to see these things and either despair or rage at them, name them and rage at them. But what you do here with this subversive prophetic voice is not only elevate the issue and reorient ourselves to the radical nature of Jesus, but then also give us a practical thing to do about it. Which I think the temptation is to not. The temptation is to say, I'm so mad, and aren't you mad? And let's post about it and feel good about ourselves for correctly being mad. And instead, we're convicted by your words and the radical words of Jesus, and then invited to these action steps. So you give two prompts and questions for people in their bulletins to wrestle with and to think about and to apply going forward. You mentioned maybe that came from Tony. I would love to hear about your relationship with asking these action steps, how you put them together, how you think through them.
Yeah, so actually the action steps start in a kind of unique way, and that's that in we use bulletins. I'm not a huge fan of the bulletins. I feel like I spend a lot of resource to get a bulletin out each week, and they're kind of a pain for me. But it's the context I'm in. Our members like it, so we do these bulletins, and in the back of the bulletin, I do something that I call an action sheet. And in it is like a verse. I usually put in two or three prompts, things for them to consider. And then I always put a word search in there. And it's kind of cool to see people doing the word search, giving them something to fiddle with. I'm told that this kind of thing can help with your engagement and focus as well. So I'm glad to do it. But so my action items often come out of these premeditated questions that I ask in this bulletin. And the idea is, and again, this was the conviction for being very intentional about having action items came again from Tony Campolo. You can tell he is a big figure in my life. And maybe it's helpful to know, my PhD research is on Tony. And so I've been interviewing him for a while, and he's been really He had been very instrumental in my career and things like that. But he is very big on always giving an action item. And so for him, for years, it was something like, in the back of the church are these envelopes with children that need to be sponsored. And so for his case, this would be Compassion International or something. I want you to go, I want you to look at those envelopes or something like that. I don't have the luxury of doing quite that, but there is always something that we can be doing, and so I want to make sure that there is some sort of action that the listener can focus on for the week. I struggle with this though too, because sometimes I don't want people to come to church and be like, oh, he's just going to give us another thing to focus on, and he's just making stuff up because he has to. Every week he has to give us a new action to do. And I try to be cognizant of that. So I keep them pretty broad. Sometimes, and they take different shapes. Sometimes I teach people how to different meditative practices, like a centering prayer has been a useful thing to teach people how to do, and invite them into that space. I try to keep these action items really simple so that you can retain them. And I really do try to keep them so they're not gimmicky. But I do want people to have some sort of action they can take throughout the week. I think in this season, I've been particularly, impacted by this idea that we are the hands and feet of Christ. And that's more a James thing, I would say, than other things, but it seems like we are imperative towards this redemption of the world. I heard on a podcast, I don't know, last week or something. It was a Pete Enns Bible for Normal People podcast, another great podcast, your colleagues, my friends. And the speaker on there, I don't remember who it was, they said, people think that we're on the Titanic. We're not on the Titanic. We're the iceberg. And that stuck with me, I think. Yeah. Teresa of Avila reflects on this a lot. There are no hands but yours. There are no bodies but yours, that kind of thing. And, this has been a big leaning for me. I don't want us to be complacent Christians, because I don't think that we can afford to be complacent Christians. I don't think that's being a Christian. This is the radical life of Jesus, and Jesus was quite radical. I've been a follower of Christ most of my life, and I'm challenged every day to be more and more like this very radical Christ. And I think that's part of the journey, looking more and more cruciform. And so my hope is that with each sermon, we can give some tools for helping us look a little bit more like Jesus, throughout the week.
It's so helpful, and I'm really convinced in the last several years of ministry. We talked about maybe less biblical literacy than maybe we would have anticipated. I think too, in how our times and cultures have changed, there's less like spiritual formation happening in people's own personal lives. And so how we can integrate that formational piece into something we're actually doing, even in the Sunday morning experience, even in the sermon experience, and then something to take with us is really vital and really helpful. And I'm trying to figure out ways to integrate that as well into my action steps or whatever my next steps or practices that we even do together. So I'm just really encouraged by how you do that. And I think it's such a great way to help people not let the sermon be disconnected from their real lives, not let their head be disconnected from their bodies. And I think in our time and in our culture, that's an easy thing. It's easy for me to do is for my head to be disconnected from my body. So I'm grateful for it.
When I first started being a lead pastor, one thing I heard a few times was, and I don't think it was a reflection on my sermons per se, but I remember hearing things like people will come to me and they're like, oh, I left that church because the pastor always challenged me. Or I come to church to feel better. I don't take this hour out of my life to feel worse about myself. And I have to be sensitive to that, but I'm also reactionary to it too. Like I see our goal as twofold here. I'm sure you could increase or decrease, but what I'm seeing is, yes, I want to encourage people in my sermons. I want them to sense the movement of God in a world that can be hard to see or hold to God's movement, but I also want to challenge people. So it's not all feel good, but we need to challenge ourselves to make things on earth as they are on heaven. I think that's the call of the disciple. Jesus calls us to make disciples. And of course, that means that we also have to be disciples, I think. And so, yes, be encouraged, but also we need to grow. There's work to be done. The world is in too desperate of a place for us not to do something. Prayers go up to heaven to God, and I'm convinced that God says, oh yeah, here's the answer to the prayer. He's right there. It's Evan. It's Hannah. It's those people sitting in those pews. I think that we are blessed to be invited on this journey of redeeming the world. Like God doesn't need us, but God chooses to invite us in the redemption of the world. But we need to take that quite seriously, I think.
Well, when you talk about, I want to be encouraged, I don't come to be discouraged or whatever, to despair. I think your model of this is good news, no, it's really, really good news. What are we going to do about it? It still engages with the reality of the situation, but puts it in this way of bringing forward that good news all the time that I think helps there, where you're not running away from the bad news, but you're also never forgetting to put that good news front and center of Jesus. And I think that's such a helpful tool.
Well said, Evan. Well said.
So you are 3 weeks out from preaching this sermon. I'm sure a lot of life has happened. I'm curious about, how is this sitting with you? What are the things in this message that you're most proud of, that you really love? What are the memorable moments for you from preaching this?
Yeah. Oh, that's a sweet question. I think as I would have given you a different response, I'm sure, if you had asked me like the day after I gave the sermon. But it's kind of cool how you get to see how the Spirit works through your sermon throughout the week. And so regardless of how I felt about it, I can say like people come and say, oh, that really helped me this week. And so that's a way of saying, oh, you were faithful to your job. Whatever that looks like. So I try, and I think what I'm reacting to, Hannah, is I always have feelings about my sermons. I'll think, oh, that was great, or oh, that was bad. But I find that my feelings don't have much to do with the reality of how they're perceived. The sermons that I think are bad, people may very much like, and it shocks me. The sermons I think are good, other people won't always connect to. And sometimes I'm amazed how I can give a sermon and hate it, and then a few years can go by, I'll be in a different context, I'll give almost the same sermon, and I'll love it. I'm like, what happened? It's almost the same words, but the context is different. The moving of the spirit is different. I'm sure lived experience is different, things like that. And one thing I can say about the sermon process for me is I do take it very seriously, just like each of you, like most pastors I know. And so I'm proud, if I can say that, of most of my sermons in that I believe I was faithful in doing the work, being prayerful, and I work very hard on them. I spend a lot of time on them. And there, I can't do any better than my best. So if this is my best, then that's what it's going to be. And God seems to work through that, you know? The only time I'm not proud of a sermon is if I feel like I didn't give it enough time throughout the week. But usually, if that happens, if life happens and I don't have enough time, usually the prayer on Sunday is, oh my gosh, God, you are so good. I can't believe you made that happen, you know? So yeah, I can be proud of these sermons because, they're not mine. It's all God. You can sense the pneumatological undertones in what I'm saying, and I really believe that this is the spirit of God, and I'm just trying to open myself up to it. I'm working on a program now. I'm starting a conference. I can't say I'm helping with a conference, but I can't say too much. But one thing we're exploring is this idea that anyone can preach. And I like this idea. This really hit with some people. Now, I don't know that anyone should preach. I don't know that anyone is prepared to preach or understands what it takes. A lot of people, I'm sure, come up to you and like, I want to preach. And you're like, well, you're getting into a lot more than you think, but okay. But I think anyone can preach so long as they're attuned to God. I mean, the Spirit will use anyone. The Spirit will use Zacchaeus, the Spirit will use tax collector Matthew. The Spirit will use a thief dying on the cross. The Spirit will use James Williams. And that's beautiful. So I'm proud of most of my sermons and that I feel like I did the work. And I did my best. And that's all I can do. There are certain moments as I'm rewatching this, I'm like, all right, James, all right, like that's cool. I really like I like to use alliteration, and when I find moments where it's done well, that's where I'm like, ah, James, that was cool, because that required a lot of work beforehand, But those aren't the moments that I think really hit with people. It's like that Matthew 25 moment, just paraphrasing what Jesus said.
Unique thing about this podcast is it's also an opportunity to look at something that you've preached, and for many of us, we may or may not review our messages after we've preached them. So as you've done that for this one, is there anything you would do differently? Is there any adjustments you would make looking back at it?
Yeah, for most, usually when I review a sermon, the adjustments I see that I would like to make are technical. And I try not to beat myself up about them. It's a losing battle there. I'll always find I have a problem, as you're probably hearing on this podcast, my friends, with speaking too quickly. I have to be intentional about pacing. I tend to move too quickly. In this particular sermon delivery, I'm reading from an iPad on a lectern. Sometimes I use a teleprompter. That has not been my luxury in a few months because my teleprompter broke. Just like a cheap iPad program, And I think that has an impact on where my eye movements go, Usually it has to do with pace. The volume seemed okay, like inflection points. I used to mark those. I don't anymore. I just practice them and see what comes out at the time, I don't know that I would do anything differently. Sometimes I look at sermons and I say I should have reordered things, but this one was okay. And I'm usually okay with the ordering because I keep the outline simple. Again, it's a point and a story. There might be superfluous stuff in there, but it's done with discretion. Usually the transitions are a point that I use either rhyme or alliteration for. And that's all very new for to me, by the way. That's like maybe the past 6 months to a year I've been employing more alliteration and poetry. But it's because my models, the model that I've been using has simplified. so I can spend more time working on that as I focus on stories. So like one thing that never comes across in like these clips, because I do the I'll clip up my sermons for social media and stuff, is the stories. But like if you were to listen to this straight through, so you listeners know that this is really just stories, stories, stories. Again, Tony Campolo, his homiletical professor at Eastern Baptist Theological Seminary at the time. This would have been in, I think, the 60s, but it might have been the 50s even. He described Tony's teacher described his sermons as the Empire State Building, stories stacked on stories stacked on stories. And that stuck with Tony, and that stuck with me. Yeah, I use a lot of stories. And Hannah, you had asked about resources. So if we have pastors listening, indeed, I use a bunch of illustration books. So that's a big part of my research too, actually, is finding stories. If I have one in my head, particularly from lived experience, great. That's really what I want to use. It's closer to me. But oftentimes I don't, or I'm looking for an inspiration that will remind me of a story in my life. And so I use a ton of illustration books. I pour through preaching illustration books, and there's just too many to name, honestly. I have them stacked around my office.
Well, if you think of more specific ones, send us an email with some of your favorite ones. I would be interested in knowing those.
I will, and I can tell you my two favorite because I have them right here. Whenever I encounter a new preacher, or if we license someone, I tend to give them two books. These are both by Tony Campolo. When I started talking with Tony, when we talked about this new model, he said, "You're going to buy these books, just go through them. There's some great stories in there." Indeed, these are hatched out stories. So one is "Let Me Tell You a Story." This is Tony's first storybook. This one's not well indexed, but so you just have to know the stories, but they're great. And no one tells stories quite like a Tony Campolo. Like these are good to go. And then Stories That Feed Your Soul. This one is much better indexed, but it doesn't have all the hits, if you would say. So these are two go-tos. And but I've used so many Tony stories, I don't get to use them as often, but you guys get to. And one thing Tony said, it told me was, never be afraid to use these stories. Just give people credit. And so you'll see when I tell a story, I'll say like Tony Campolo says this, or Hannah Brown tells this time where she or Evan Duncan does this thing. Now, what is frustrating is people will come to me and they'll be like, "Now, did that really happen to you?" And I'm like, "No, I never said that happened to me. I said Evan Duncan said this story." And Tony had mentioned that he had similar things. Tony Campolo's most famous sermon is "It's Friday, but Sunday's coming." But as you'll hear at the beginning of every presentation of this sermon, it is not his sermon. He was present, and this was a sermon of a pastor in front of him, who showed up all the other pastors with this great sermon. And nothing preaches like "It's Friday, but Sunday's coming." And so Tony says all that, but everyone forgets that it was another preacher's sermon. It becomes Tony's, and that's kind of the risk. But yeah, if you give people credit, I think it's okay to do that.
So, one of the things that we are deeply curious about as preachers and as people who are deeply committed to the church and to preaching, why do you think that preaching matters today?
Well, preaching does matter today. Again, this goes back to we are tasked with bringing the word of God for the people of God for that day, that time, that hour. Each of our weeks has so much stuff, and I guess that's just as broad as I can be. Who knows what's in a week? But in our context, people set aside an hour, 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours to go and interact in community and encounter God in community. While in this community, we need to lean into this idea that they can encounter God and that God is speaking. And as pastors, we get to invite people into that presence. I think if there weren't pastors, people would say, "Yeah, I think this is true." But now they have pastors who are joining them in this journey of saying, "Yes, God is speaking. God is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living." And guess what? We who live on this earth, God has things to say for each of us. Now let's discern it together, and let's discern how we're going to move together. I think this is also part of the beauty of community. I've been really impacted in the past decade or so On the value of community, I didn't grow up in a particularly community-driven theology. I think in around 2010, I read a systematic theology book. This is before I went to seminary, though, by Stanley Grenz, who had just passed, I think, in 2005, a Baptist theologian. He wrote Theology for the Community of God, and in it, he posits that outside of community, God ceases to exist. Because God always exists in the triune community, if you will. And that stuck with me. Like, it seems like, yeah, we're made for community. We're made for each other. My twin brother works on reality TV shows, and one of the shows he did involved people going out into like the wilderness for months at a time by themselves. And these are survival experts who've done this their whole life, and they're wholly convinced that they can go and live in the wilderness, no problem, for a year. And indeed, they have the skills to do so. But what I find and what I hear from my brother is indeed also true, is that in isolation, humans go crazy. We are not made to live alone. And I'm not talking like 6 months down the line. I'm saying like 10 days in, people start to go whack without other forms of communication. And we see that in like solitary confinement. And there's a reason that it's considered egregious punishment. We're made for community. And so preaching not only brings this word of God for the people of God for that day, but he brings it in a community, in a way to say, we are all in this together. You are not alone. Rather, we are all discerning this, and we can co-discern together too, by the way. Us pastors do not, at least in my tradition, us pastors do not have the say. We don't have that special VIP access to God. I think of us, as just professional laity who are blessed to be able to do this. But it's not something that has been true of every Christian in every age, And I imagine that many churches are struggling with having to have full-time pastors, and that's okay. God will always raise up those to serve God's people, and I believe that we'll always have this com these communities. But the community is the key point, not the pastor. God will work through the community, I think.
Well, James, this has been fantastic. Thank you for giving of your time and being willing to work through a sermon together. We've been just blessed and impacted by your preaching and your time, and I just want to thank you again for your ministry, for the things that you're doing in inner city Philadelphia, and the great, great work of community that you're surrounded with and part of. So, thank you, James.
Thank you both. This was so much fun. I am blessed. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Preacher Handshake. Please share and like and subscribe to this podcast. And if you have questions or maybe a preacher you think we need to talk to, send us an email at preacherhandshake@gmail.com.